Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Chris Evans.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a pre-recorded production of Entercom Communications. My name is Chris Evans. Today, my guest is Dr. Saria Sicosio, the Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer at Prisma Health. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Chris.
Thank you for being here again. And this is now episode 21 of the COVID Chronicles. So we were actually just talking before the show, and I guess this is as good a place to start as any, about masks. I mean, masks are still such a big topic of conversation. And I should also point out, as we have said a number of times, this pandemic is a virus that was previously unknown. A year ago, we had never heard of this virus. It did not that it didn't necessarily exist, but it certainly didn't exist in humans. It was not something that humans were known for catching. So all of our learning about it has happened in the past 8-9 months or so. And so there's still a large amount about it that we don't know. And one of the things that we are studying is how masks work. And I found, we were talking about this before the program, I found a study, it was published, I think this past week, maybe the week before, but it was from Duke University, and it was about the effectiveness of different types of masks. And this was really interesting to me because some of them are effective in terms of catching the virus particles, catching those droplets of water that carry the virus that we've talked about, just people exhale on a normal basis, you know, either from speaking or just breathing. Some of the masks will catch it. Some of them basically don't. It's like wearing nothing at all. And then some of them, it turns out, are actually worse than wearing nothing. And that was fascinating to me. Apparently, the kinds that are best at catching them are the ones that we've heard about, the N95 masks. Sometimes they're labeled KN95. I'm not sure exactly what the distinction there is, but I know there is an actual difference. Those are the ones that actually catch the particles that are small as viruses.
Yeah, so I want to pause right there, Chris, because I think this is an important topic.
Yes.
And one that, honestly, perhaps some people are exhausted with. And I understand why people feel like, well, you say wear a mask, you don't wear a mask. You say this is a safe mask, no, this is not a safe mask. And while people may be frustrated with the evidence, or sometimes we feel like those people were wrong or these people were right, we continue to build on the evidence. So we still believe masks are critical to saving lives. We know this.
It's generally speaking.
When we didn't wear masks, yes, when we didn't wear masks, we saw more hospitalizations, more deaths. When we started wearing masks, less hospitalizations, less deaths. But here's where it matters, and I'll use the example of seatbelts. So before we had seatbelts, we had a significant issue with injuries, and we had more people die. And sure. Then we put in lap belts, and we thought, well, lap belts will be great. It'll keep people in place. Well, we've all learned, and again, through the evidence, we didn't say, well, seatbelts didn't work. Look at these people who had issues with lap belts. No, we created a better seatbelt. So we have our across
the chest strap,
and across
yeah.
our lap. Exactly. And I would say the same for car seat safety. Now we have a 5-point harness.
Yes.
So we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, if you will. We continue to build on the theories that we know that have been true. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some dangerous situations, and we've talked about that. The N95 masks, yes, that's going to be closer to 99% protective. Now, surgical masks are also great and very helpful. Where we're starting to run into trouble is really the fashion of masks.
Yes.
The fashion of masks and the filtering of masks. There are these fancy-looking filter masks that are more useful in a construction site where you're trying to blow your air out. If you have a filter on your mask, it's probably not a safe mask to protect you against COVID. That doesn't matter.
Or to protect other people from COVID.
Exactly, exactly. So thank you for pointing that out. It's the fashionable masks that may or may not be safe. The CDC.gov website can be very helpful for guidance. But again, what was recommended before, multiple layers of fabric can be helpful. But you want to make sure that you choose a mask that is safe, with multiple layers, that is relatively form-fitting around your nose and your mouth. Both should be covered. So headline news, Chris.
Yes.
Wearing a mask around your neck is not protective against COVID.
No.
It may look cool, and you may get exhausted and wear it around your neck or forget to put it on your nose and mouth. But that's what's so important. Let's stay with the basics, and the basics still work.
Well, and that was one of the interesting things. And speaking of the construction masks, I don't know how fashionable they are, but they certainly are opportune. They're available at, you know, any kind of construction store, a hardware store, that kind of thing. And it's, I get the sense that a lot of people think these masks are fungible in a way that one mask is going to be just as good as any other mask. And so they just pick up the first mask they can find. And if that happens to be a construction mask, the kind of thing that you would use to cover your face if you were painting or doing construction work that creates a lot of dust, a lot of sawing or something like that, that's going to keep that dust from getting into your face, you know, into your respiratory system while you're doing the work that you're doing. But it's not necessarily going to be as effective for trapping virus particles, whether they're coming or going. And the
That's
other ones,
correct.
Yeah, exactly. The other ones, as you mentioned, the fashionable masks, the balaclavas that people have, they're basically just a tube that you slide over your head and pull up over your mouth and nose, and frequently have something printed on them. You know, they have, you know, interesting designs on them. Other people are using bandanas, basically all of the makeshift masks. The ones that are, again, sort of opportune. If somebody just grabs a handkerchief and says, oh, I can tie this around my head and it'll be fine as a mask. Those were found by this study, interestingly enough, to be almost worse than wearing nothing, because what it found is that they were breaking up these water droplets. These droplets that we exhale that carry the virus, breaking them up into smaller bits so that they suspended in the air longer. So if they were larger, if you were wearing no mask, they would be larger and would fall to the ground and be out of anybody's way and be unlikely to infect anybody. But by breaking them up, they stay suspended in the air longer and become a bigger risk.
Yes, they may keep you warm in the winter, but they won't protect you from COVID.
Yeah. Which, again, not exactly what those masks are designed to do. You need to find masks. It's important. That, I think, was the upshot of this research was, get a mask that's actually effective. Wear a mask that works, not just any mask will do, which is kind of, again, as we've been learning more and more, that was the advice a while ago, you know, 2-3 months ago, was put something over your face. It doesn't matter what it is. Just as long as it's anything covering your face, it'll be better than nothing. We're finding out now that's not necessarily true. There are things that do work, but there are other things that don't work as well as we thought they might.
That's correct. And with more science and knowledge behind us, we're getting better and better at what we recommend and what's safe and why it can be confusing and why the data confuses us sometimes, because we learn some of the masks we're testing with weren't at the same quality or as equitable as other masks, such as the N95s or surgical masks.
Yeah. And masks have become such a fashion statement. I mean, it's almost becoming a fad to wear masks. But again, they tend to be these masks that are not really effective. I know you and I talked before. I don't remember if this was on the program or off the air, but I had seen a fashion accessory. It was a kind of bodysuit that you could pull up. It had a thick collar that you could pull up, almost like a turtleneck collar that you could pull up over your face like a mask. Like, it was intended. That's the intention, was that this collar can be pulled up over your face like a mask. Except the whole thing was made of fishnet, and it was, I was like, that's not going to catch anything. That's like wearing no mask at all. But the fashion statements that people are making with masks now may ultimately prove to be detrimental.
Yes. It makes for a quite humorous meme, if you will, but not necessarily an effective filter.
Well, and another thing that I know that we have talked about is, I had wondered about the notion of masks, again, effective masks, obviating the need for social distance and vice versa. If you're wearing a mask that works, do you really need to be socially distant? Or if you're being socially distant, do you really need to wear a mask? Obviously, two approaches are probably more effective than one, but you would hope that one would be very effective and then you wouldn't need the other. The incident that I noticed the other day, I was at the gas station putting gas in my car, and I noticed a man at a pump, I don't know, 2 or 3 pumps away from me, and he was wearing a mask and there was nobody around him. And I was just kind of curious. I was like, is that actually helping? Because 6 feet of social distance has been kind of the guideline that we've been working with so far. Forget 6 feet. There was nobody within 20 feet of him. And I was like, if you can catch it at 20 feet, we're all going to get it at some point.
Yeah, so that is a challenge right now. And this is an area where we still need more information. The current evidence and what's recommended from the CDC is 6 feet. Now, it's not that all of a sudden the particle reaches a 6 feet distance and falls to the ground.
Right, there's some invisible wall or something.
Correct, and we're still learning. We still do not yet know everything there is to know about this virus. Heck, we don't know everything there is to know about the flu virus, and that has been around for how many years?
Hundreds.
And so this is an area, yes, we will pay close attention to, and as we see our children go back to school, we're going to learn even more. We're going to learn more about spacing, what's appropriate, what is safe. As more studies are performed, it adds to the body of knowledge that we have to help us base our guidance and what's going to be safest. Because here's the situation. Nothing is 100%.
Right.
So even an N95 mask, there is still a 0.11% chance of picking up a virus particle.
Well, and you see that on cleansers too, you know, soap and stuff.
Yeah.
That it says kills 99.9% of the, you know, infectious bacteria. It's not 100%.
Correct. But you want to be as safe as you can and at the same time being reasonable. So this is why the recommendations continue to be strengthened, refined. And as we learn information, sometimes we do make corrections. So it's important that we're taking all of that information, evaluating it through a science-based lens to then put out to the public what's recommended based on evidence that exists, and we continue to evolve.
Well, and one of the studies that I came across just a couple days ago was out of the University of Florida. It was a hospital study where they were studying hospital patients, patients who had been hospitalized with COVID-19, and we're trying to figure out how the virus moves around indoors, because that's, again, one of the guidelines that we've seen is don't go out unless you need to. Stay home and isolate yourself and make sure that, you know, that's part of the social distancing, is that people are not going out and being social as often as they used to. What they found, this was fascinating, is that not only is 6 feet, you know, where they can detect the viruses, but they found them as far away as 16 feet. And again, that seems like if we're going to send kids back to school, 16 feet is like two, maybe three kids per classroom. But then you were telling me that there was another study that said it might be even less than 6 feet in classrooms.
That's correct. And so it will be an interesting opportunity. We're already seeing schools around us, whether it's Georgia or Indiana. I'm sure you've heard the same stories I've heard. Over 100,000 children in the recent past have contracted COVID. And as we've seen schools open, some have closed, and some have also been excellent at social distancing, wearing masks, and being consistent with their policies and procedures. So time will tell, and what I'm looking forward to is the information that's developed and how we decide to send our children back the safest way to protect everyone, including our teachers and our staff in our schools, to be safe.
And part of the reason that these kinds of measures are so important is, I mean, early on when we were talking about this, it was about flattening the curve and making sure, and I think we did that. I think it's the hospitals, at least around here, never got overwhelmed with, you know, an inundation of patients to the point that they couldn't take in more people and treat them. And so I think that helped. I think it was effective. Now we're more focused on the fact that so many people are asymptomatic and can be spreading the virus without really knowing it.
True. That is the case. And just like the flu and just like other conditions, tuberculosis, which is also a very serious respiratory condition, there's always risk. We need to be mindful. We need to learn the best ways to protect ourselves and others. And these different environments will help us to do that. So, and I understand people are frustrated at the same time. There are ways to open up businesses, as we've seen. Some have done it extremely well. And in fact, I think it's important just to give a shout out to our community right now, Chris. When I think about the dramatic reduction in the cases we've seen recently, and when I look around and I see people wearing masks, I see people social distancing, I see in restaurants the spacing between the tables, we're doing a much better job of doing what we know works. So again, just compliments to our community, and I thank you all for keeping everyone safe in the upstate.
Indeed. Thanks very much. The asymptomaticity of this particular infection is something that I've found intriguing, because I'm not really familiar with that as a characteristic of other infections. You mentioned influenza and tuberculosis. Is it normal for people to get flu and then spread it without ever having any symptoms?
Well, that's an excellent question, Chris, and one I'm not familiar of much research being done where we tested people who were asymptomatic for flu.
Fair enough.
So my scientific brain would tell me that we would likely see individuals who are asymptomatic that are also carrying the flu virus around and potentially infecting others. So I think this is an excellent reminder for us to say we don't know what we don't know yet. And just because someone isn't exhibiting symptoms, they're not feeling it themselves, does not necessarily mean they're not infecting others. So in this season that we're approaching, this flu and COVID season, I would say the best thing we can do is protect ourselves. And I'm going to give a plug for the flu shot, for the flu vaccine. Mm-hmm. Later this month, in fact, August 28th, we go live in all of our primary care practices. We'll be offering the flu vaccine and many other sites to come. We're partnering with our community. Protect yourself against the flu and other illnesses where we know we have immunizations and vaccines to help protect and prevent respiratory illness in this season quickly approaching.
Well, and that's one thing that I wanted to talk about is, how is flu season going to affect this COVID-19 pandemic? I mean, so many of the symptoms of COVID-19 are similar to symptoms of the flu. Is it going to be difficult to tell the difference whether people have that or the flu?
Yes, and I will share with you that our experts at Prisma Health are concerned and are actively preparing for what this will look like. The flu and the COVID-19 symptoms are essentially the same. There is no difference when you consider fever or cough or sore throat or even GI symptoms. That nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea has also been seen in the flu in the past. Mm-hmm. So it will be very important that we're diligent for both, that we are intentional about how we test and evaluate individuals and make sure everyone has access to appropriate care and appropriate testing.
So how are we going to tell the difference? If somebody presents with these symptoms, I mean, they're going to have to get a COVID-19 test.
Well, yes, we are already developing plans to ensure that many patients who are presenting for COVID-19 will also have access to flu testing. And those that originally we would only test for the flu because we heard they had flu in their family, it was in the household, will be considering and have a high suspicion for also dually testing for COVID-19. What we originally thought and saw was that there was very little co-infection, if you will, or an infection of both flu and COVID-19 in the same body. Mm-hmm. Well, over time, we continue to learn more, and what we've seen is upwards of perhaps 20-25%, you can potentially have a co-infection in one person with both flu and COVID. So now you take a family or you take a household with people in that house, and it's very possible to have both flu and COVID-19 at home.
What happens if somebody has both at once? Is it particularly more dangerous?
Well, yes, indeed it is. It's just like having any two infections at one time. They're two different attacks on the body. So if you have flu, then it may be appropriate to treat you with a drug we use called Tamiflu to lessen your symptoms, because we want your body to be the strongest it can be to help protect you against COVID-19. Now, as we've seen, upwards between 80 to 85% of individuals who contract COVID-19 have a relatively mild illness. But here's the challenge. We don't know exactly how to predict what the other 15% and who those 15% will be. So we've got to protect everyone. This year, everyone has that added risk of COVID-19. And for that reason, if you are 6 months of age or older, we absolutely and strongly, passionately recommend the flu immunization this year.
What's the news on treating COVID-19? I know remdesivir has been generally distributed. I'm not sure how much of it there is. There's still a lot of debate over the effectiveness of hydroxychloroquine. What have we learned so far since the last time we talked about remedies?
Yes. So what we typically see is primarily these medications are intended for patients who are hospitalized for the most part. You mentioned remdesivir.
Right.
That's a medication that is still proving to be helpful to shorten that hospitalization stay. We're also seeing dexamethasone, or a standard generic steroid we've used for decades. It has also been proven to save lives with COVID-19. Plasmapheresis, we talked last week on our COVID Chronicles about donating plasma and how important plasmapheresis has been in the favorable results. But let's talk about hydroxychloroquine for a moment. And this has created so much controversy across our country, new evidence, new information. And for that reason, I've really taken a deep dive to better understand personally myself what we're seeing out there with studies. One person says, well, we have a study that says hydroxychloroquine is harmful in COVID-19. Then we have another study that says, no, it's not harmful, it's hopeful. And so for that reason, no wonder why our public must be confused. In fact, I think many scientists are struggling or scratching their head with the same. However, when you drill down into the research, what we're seeing is perhaps a mix, a slight mix. In the studies I've reviewed, that were even perhaps randomized, there was a slightly, perhaps, improvement, but it was statistically insignificant, meaning it didn't make a difference overall. Now, in other cases, and the ones that are most concerning to me and what we're beginning to see more of, is that hydroxychloroquine actually had harmful adverse effects. We've heard many times about the potential effects on the heart. We know that you can have arrhythmias, or where that rhythm of your heart can be abnormal. And we know when you're infected with COVID-19, you can be at greater risk for this. And here's what we're also starting to see in the research, the neuropsychiatric effects. So what does that mean? We're seeing people, up to 12% of individuals, and these are folks who perhaps took hydroxychloroquine for malaria. So we recognize this isn't a new drug, and it's been used for other illnesses, but it even had side effects then. Side effects such as depression, insomnia, hallucinations, or seeing things that aren't really there. And what we've also learned is some of those symptoms persist even after the medication has been discontinued. So we continue to learn more and more about these medications. And so for those reasons, it is still strongly not recommended after the additional evidence came forward. The FDA has even come out and said they no longer recommend hydroxychloroquine for the treatment of COVID-19. So we need to heed those comments and those remarks. I don't think we're hiding information. We'll continue to watch the evidence that comes forward. But if you have even 50% of the studies that say it's harmful, and maybe 50% that say it's insignificant, but maybe a blip, I don't know. I wouldn't want to put my mother or myself at risk for harm at this point when we have medications that have consistently proven successful results, even cheap or more cost-effective medications.
Well, and
so
when
this is not about money.
When you get conflicting results like that, like we had with the masks and the social distancing studies, it seems, if nothing else, to indicate that more research is needed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll no doubt see more research come out about hydroxychloroquine, again, because of the controversy. Mm-hmm. However, if we have several medications that are not only promising, but early studies continue to prove that the benefit is greater than any risk, then that's where I would lean at this time.
Sure. Understand. Dr. Saria Sicosio has been our guest. As always, we should mention prismahealth.org/coronavirus. where you can get more information about how Prisma is helping the community, testing sites, mobile testing sites, hospital testing sites. We actually had a note in the newsroom just this past week that we should reiterate the point that if you are going to a hospital testing site, you need to make sure that you have been ordered to by a doctor, that you've got a doctor's note or some sort of instruction from a doctor to go get tested at the hospital testing sites. The mobile sites, as I understand it, you don't need that, but they tend to take a little longer. It seems like the lines get longer at those places.
And correct. And depending on how many cases we have active in the community, the longer the line. So if we protect ourselves, we'll have a shorter line, Chris. So that's the good news. And yes, make sure you have a provider's order. And if you don't have a provider, a primary care provider, first of all, as a family physician, I recommend you have one. And we also have services that continue to be free of charge. If you go to prismahealth.org/coronavirus, you can access our virtual visits for free assessments of coronavirus symptoms.
Again, that's prismahealth.org/coronavirus. We should also mention 1063WORD.com as a place where you can find news about the pandemic in general, not necessarily related to Prisma Health, but more general news about the coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Saria Sicosio, the Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer for Prisma Health, has been my guest again today. Thank you for being here, Doctor.
My pleasure. Be safe and be well.
Be safe and be well to you, too. We'll do it again next week.
All right. Take care, Chris.
I'm Chris Evans, and this has been Focus on the Upstate.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Chris Evans. If you would like more information on today's topic, email Chris at cevans@intercom.com.